Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. We're having a conversation, as I said, with our buddy Jonathan Lemire in his new book, The Big Lie. So, Jonathan, I have contended for, like, and John's like, okay, maybe I should have left right at the break. But there was a role. Everybody had a role in this at various level stages, and the media is not exempt. And how would you assess the media coverage of Trump's ability to perpetuate or stifle the big lie, and the role that they played in that narrative? I mean, like you, as you said, you know, you along with a handful of journalists who were, you know, assigned Trump back in 2015 were kind of rolling their eyes, going, oh my God, why am I doing that? Who did I piss off to get this assignment? Turned into something way more than that. And there were various times where the media seemed to be applauding, maybe the wrong word, but at least giving platform to a lot of this, even before Trump got to the White House.
Absolutely right. And I think there are two different camps here, and we'll return to the conservative media in a moment. Mm-hmm. But I think even what we deem the mainstream media, certainly in those early days, was culpable. It's had to do a lot of soul searching since. The book details, and that there was one rally, infamously, where Trump was an hour or two late from starting, and CNN had a camera up the entire time on the empty podium, and the anchors just kind of vamped around it because they were not going to break away, because Trump was so good for ratings, because people either watched him because they loved him or they hated him, but they watched him. He was sort of like that car wreck you couldn't take your eyes off of for right. some, but people still tuned in. I think that all of the media, both print as well as television, radio, initially didn't know what to do with him. We had never encountered someone like this who lied so easily and lied about everything. And not just as a candidate, I'm sure, Michael, you remember that when he was elected, I didn't believe in this, but there was a school of thought out there that, well, maybe when Trump takes office and he'll adhere more to the norms of the presidency and he'll mellow out, he'll calm down. None of that happened. And he blew right through every convention. And the media wasn't ready. We didn't understand that we had to fact check everything he said. I mean, yes, we're always skeptical of power, but traditionally, if a White House statement is put out from the press secretary or whoever, you tend to believe that it's at least based in fact. And that was no longer the case with him. Right. And I think a lot of us, you know, because of the medium of Twitter and emphasis on speed and getting out fast, we just sometimes would regurgitate almost verbatim what he would say. And it was true. He said that. But what he said wasn't true. And therefore, we weren't providing the necessary context, the necessary fact-checking that we should have. And I think that there was a time the media really had to do some soul-searching about that. And I will say it improved. By the time the 2020 election rolled around, and particularly after that election, like, it was rare that any network would carry his remarks live without fact-checking. Because they knew we all had, at that point, adjusted to the idea that he would lie so much you couldn't just let him have an open stage. We had to provide some context.
How did they get caught in that in the first place? I mean, we're talking, you know, some of the bigger networks and some of the bigger stars in journalism who were entrapped in that web of lies and deceit. How did that even happen? What was it about? Was it just this guy's good for ratings and you know, we know we'll get the clicks on our website and so forth and so on? Was it really that basic, or was there something else there that we just didn't see or recognize at that time?
I think he was a compelling character. There was drama there. It was people wanted to watch, and maybe for all the wrong reasons,
right?
But they did. But they did. And I do think that the ratings is part of it. I mean, Donald Trump lies about everything, or just about everything. The one thing he has told the truth on is when he said that he was good for ratings. And we have seen that in his absence, ratings, clicks, subscriptions, however you want to measure it, have all fallen off. Now, we can have a larger conversation about how just this media ecosystem has changed. But still, his stepping off the stage has played a role as well, because people were watching to cheer him on, or they were watching in horror at what he was doing. So I do think that's a big part of it. And then the part two of this, of course, is the conservative media, which at times, you know, was very much enabling for everything he wanted to do. There were moments where Fox News felt like it was part of the White House press shop. He then was given, you know, unfettered of access and availability to their airwaves. And we know the number of times that suddenly Fox News, and not just Fox News, but other conservative outlets would almost create things, it seemed, to help White House and Trump narratives. And networks emerged that were to the right of Fox News for those who didn't think Fox News was conservative enough. Now, so I think that was part of it too, is that Trump accelerated, it existed ahead of time, before him, but it accelerated the polarization of our political landscape, but also the media landscape. And it became ever more so Team Red versus Team Blue.
You very expertly, and again, I you know, folks, if you're going to read any book, certainly this summer, about this period, I highly recommend Jonathan's, because it is literally like picking up your newspaper with a cup of coffee in the morning and just diving in. I mean, it is so well done. You have when you get into the Biden era, after we get through the trauma of January 6th and the Biden administration, you begin to lay out the tentacles of the big lie and the impact it had on the Biden administration, the strangulation of certain policy initiatives, particularly in the areas of voting and so forth. Walk us through a little bit of that part of your book where you kind of, you know, you sort of lay out, hey, this, it just didn't stop when Trump finally left town.
No, it's
that the current administration is still sitting there going, what the hell? I just want to try to get something done.
No question. The January 6th is only about the midway point in this book. And the big lie has, to use your image, lots of tentacles, one of which Trump had so convinced so many of his followers that the election was in fact rigged that polling suggests that more than half of Republicans don't believe Joe Biden was legitimately elected. No. And therefore that of course hurts his ability to lead, and Republicans see those numbers. And even in their hearts, they might believe that Joe Biden was legitimately elected, but they're not going to cooperate with him because they know they're going to pay a price with their voters. So there's that. There is, as you mentioned, that there was an effort to have new federal voting rights legislation as a reaction to what the White House saw in the states, that they saw that a number of Republican state legislatures, some measures relatively small, some more widespread, were trying to reform election laws in the wake of Trump's big lie. They're using that as an excuse to say, hey, we need to tighten things. And analysts believe that the new restrictions, the new measures, would disproportionately affect those people who tend to vote Democrat. So there was that. The effort, however, on Capitol Hill failed because some Democrats, you know, with no Republican support or very little, you know, they needed all 50 Democratic senators, and Senators Manchin and Sinema publicly, a few others privately, worried about blowing up the filibuster in order to do so. So that measure was doomed earlier this year. And I think we've also simply seen a Biden White House, which had believed, and they certainly were clear-eyed as to the danger that Trump was, but had believed he might fade from the stage after he left office. And I, for a while there, really focused on other things. Somewhat can't be blamed. This was, remember, early 2021, the pandemic was front and center. But there were some civil rights groups, and the book gets into this too, sounding the alarm as early as spring, summer of 2021, saying, hey, Trump is still very much a presence. This is an existential threat to our democracy, what we're seeing here with the access to the ballot. And there's a belief the White House moved a little too slowly, and then it was too late. And we are seeing now in 2022, with Trump backing candidates, not just for things like the Senate, but also for governor races, for state secretaries of state, basically positions where those officials will have a role going forward, counting and certifying the vote. So there's great concern just that for future elections, Americans, A, may not be able to trust to be able to cast their ballot, and B, won't be able to trust their vote will be counted, and C, may not even be able to trust that the rightful winner will be allowed to assume office.
You set a great scene, and there are a number of great scenes where you sort of lay out the moment, for example, when the president goes to Philadelphia and has his that speech, where he talks about basically, you know, we're facing the most significant test of our democracy, et cetera. But then it was the scene in the Roosevelt Room with the historians, and this you talk about how Biden wanted to sort of embrace this idea that had been floated up about him becoming the next LBJ or the next FDR. Was that, in your estimation, a response to the absolute abject nature of the Trump administration? Was there real policy goals there? Because again, I think in some respects, there was a misreading by a lot of the Biden people about what his presidency should be versus what they wanted it to be. What it should be is a transition from Trumpism. So that means democracy all day, 24 hours a day, all the time, which is the argument I made when he gave the State of the Union, was he should have spent time connecting the fight for our democracy here to the fight that Ukraine is engaging in for democracy there, and show that this is not just a problem here, but a global one. And yeah, you can talk about COVID response and the economy and things like that, but that should be the driver of it. And yet they seem to have gotten on the road to this idea of making him the next LBJ with, you know, the next, you know, great society program, or, you know, even bigger with sort of this FDR approach to voting and the economy and the environment, and the people kind of yawned at it. What was missed there in your view? In all of that,
there's certainly been a lot of second guessing about it. And the difference, the fundamental difference between what Joe Biden had versus what FDR and LBJ had, these sort of titans of Democratic presidents who had these sweeping social programs, is that both Johnson and FDR, at least to start, had huge majorities in Congress, and Joe Biden did not. So it was a tie in the Senate, only a handful of seats in the House, and it would have been that much more difficult to get things done, particularly when you do have members of your own party, but who are very disparate in terms of what they believe in and the people they represent. But I also think there is that, to your larger point, that I think that there was a sense then that America was sort of exhausted, exhausted by Trump, exhausted by the pandemic. And certainly Biden's first efforts were on the pandemic, but there is a sense among some Democrats that there was that overreach, especially considering how small his margins were. And therefore what happened was he had, whether it was the Build Back Better agenda, whether it was efforts on voting rights, whether they're, you know, the first efforts at gun reform, the one smaller bipartisan measure did get through, incremental, but did get through, whether it is measures on climate change, whether it is, you know, this latest effort to try to codify abortion rights in the wake of the Roe v. Wade overturn. They kept coming up short. They just weren't able to get those things done. And that led to, that furthered a sense among voters of just that Washington was broken, that the Democrats, you know, weren't able to get things done. And this is general unhappiness that I think, you know, polling suggests Americans have not been very happy for a few years now, as we're also dealing with the pandemic and everything else. I think there was a hope that there would be a little more competency and functioning of government. And to this point, but let's be clear, the Biden administration has achieved some pretty significant things, but the overall sense around it, the mood around it, was that it was coming short, falling short. And I think that's hampered their ability to get things done going forward too.
Hey everybody, thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.